is a prayer that my teacher Prabhupada instituted as part of the protocol for every class that he gave. He would sing this particular song, and it's a very lovely song that celebrates Krishna in Vrindavan. Now, that was always Prabhupada's purpose, was to introduce people to that very intimate side of Krishna's nature in his village. And the verse that we're going to be talking about today in Bhagavad Gita is quite apropos, because Krishna talks about, as people come to me, I am reciprocating with them. I think it's 4 verse 9, but we'll get to that in a minute. So let's try this Jaya Radha Madhava prayer together. I'll chant one line and then we'll chant it together. Does that sound okay? All right. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari. You want to try that with me? Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari. Very simple. Second one. Janna bala ba girivadarhari. Try that with me. Gopi janna bala ba girivadarhari. The third line. Jasoda nandana braja jana ranjana. Try that one. Yasoda nandana braja jana ranjana. And then the last line. Yamuna sira vanachari. Yamuna sira vanachari. So I'm going to trick it out a little bit here on harmonium, but that's basically the song and the melody, right? Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari. Gopi Janna Balaba Girivadarhari. Gopi Janna Balaba Girivadarhari. Yasoda Nandana Raja Jana Ranjana. Yasoda Nandana Raja Jana Jasoda nandana braja jana ranjana. Jasoda nandana braja jana ranjana. Jamuna tira banachari. Jamuna tira. Jana Balaba Girivadarhari. Description of Krishna's world, Krishna's life in Vrindavan, is a very fitting introduction to the verse that we'll talk about this evening, which is 4th chapter, verse 11, on page 197.
Okay.
Well, just before we get started with discussion of this seminal verse. This is one of those very famous verses of the Bhagavad Gita that really anyone who claims to understand Bhagavad Gita, this is one of the verses that you absolutely have to know. It's really critical for reasons that we'll discuss. That's on 197. So just before we get into this verse, how's everybody doing? How was your week? Haven't seen you in a while. I had the flu, and Gadadhar Pandit subbed last Tuesday. Were you here for last week?
Great.
Yeah, he's a lovely, lovely man.
Yeah.
He told you all about what he's doing. You know, he's the chaplain up at Columbia. Did he mention that?
He mainly talked about the story, LMA. Mm-hmm. And he didn't, not so much his present.
Well, he is the Hindu chaplain at Columbia University. And he holds regular Bhagavad Gita discussion groups up there. And he was for many years giving a cooking class, a vegetarian cooking class, which is was you know, 60, 70 people covering every week to it.
He makes the best khichdi that I know. Personally.
Yes. And good khichdi. If you can make a good khichdi, you know what khichdi is? Khichdi is a combination of rice, basmati rice usually, which is not refined, you know, it's not white processed rice, and dal, which is a very high protein lentil. And you can pressure cook it in a very short time. You cook the two of them together with some spices, and usually some ghee,
which is clarified butter. I'm whispering because at Jiva Mukti, they don't like that you should use dairy.
But traditionally, that's the recipe.
But Ayurvedic medicine, they don't consider that dairy.
That's not considered dairy?
Not in Ayurvedic
really?
Medicine.
Wow, okay. Well, if you're a strict vegan, you could probably use olive oil. Anyway, dal is hugely nutritious. It's almost pure protein. Ounce for ounce, it's more protein than any other source. So all you got to do is put these two things together, rice and dal, and you have amino acid complementarity, which creates very high protein content. And it's delicious. You throw some veggies in there. It's great. And it's a hearty breakfast. That's a great way to start the day. It was also Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati's favorite dish. My teacher, Prabhupada's guru, khichdi was his favorite recipe.
And you had it to start the day?
I haven't had it in quite a while, actually. But when I was living in the temple, we used to have it quite regularly. Yeah.
Every Sunday.
Every Sunday they serve it at the Bhakti Center?
And then
okay.
There's a dal that you add like asparagus, some kind of toxin removing vegetable.
Uh-huh.
You add a little barley or taro root, then that finds the toxins and can actually close the toxins out of your body.
Oh, now you're talking. Now you're talking.
That's so every Sunday at 1 o'clock,
right. Asparagus and taro root.
Let us know. We'll make
We should actually, you know what? We should probably institute, along with everything else we're doing every week, one recipe a week.
Yeah.
You know, something simple. Would that be of interest to
yeah,
you? Would you like?
Yeah, that, I was just thinking this would be awesome.
All right. Well, there's a.
Where do I get dal?
Dal? You can get dal at Whole Foods.
Yeah.
You can get dal. Is it made like, I've seen it, it's almost like a liquid.
No, dal is little lentil beans.
Right, so
like split peas. They look like split peas.
Hummus,
that's chickpeas.
No, I know, there's made that kind of.
That consistency?
Consistency?
It has a little bit more of a tooth to it, a little bit more of a chewiness.
Okay.
It's not that smooth.
Okay.
No. It's cooked down. The rice tends to blend. Sometimes the dal retains a certain kind of chewiness. But it's just, it's just perfect.
Lung bean, and then there's also one, so you have to get a little bit more into Ayurvedic before they'll tell you this, but you go to the Indian food store and it's called horse gram, and it's actually a lentil, and you take a handful of it, and you boil water, and you let that soak overnight, and then you drain it, dry it, grind it, and you add it to your dal, and that you're supposed to do like once a week. It's to cleanse you. But it's a special lentil.
See, now next time, I think we have to write Karen's recipe down. That's a more sophisticated khichdi recipe, I think, than I've ever encountered. Okay. So we can do that. You know, I have a book of under 20-minute preparations from Yamuna. So I can bring that in and we'll go over that together. That'd be very nice.
Can you also include where to find a bad shop?
Sure. Yeah, there's places.
And even on, gets water under stuff like mine that's really pure.
Uh-huh.
So I'll write that down too.
You can get dal at like
grocery
store.
Right.
Yeah.
How quickly the conversation comes round to food. Isn't it amazing? Oh, sure. Go to any of those Indian grocery stores on Lexington Avenue in the 20s.
Uh-huh.
You'll get all kinds of great stuff.
Bag of, like,
or they have it loose. You know, you just with a ladle, you know, you'll scoop out
part of it.
And
then
important,
though, too, is the
season. Can you explain the difference between prasad and boga?
Boga is food that has not been sanctified with prayer. Prasadam is that same dish, whatever it is you're making. That has first been, the first portion has been placed in a bowl on an altar, which you can make yourself at home just by putting a picture of Radha and Krishna and the spiritual masters, Chaitanya, and then offering a simple prayer. If you don't know the formal prayers, you can just chant the Hare Krishna mantra, and you will actually taste a difference. I kid you not. The same dish offered with prayer and sanctified, that you've put some intent into it, physically alters the taste of that. I don't know how it happens, but it actually alters the flavor of the food. There's nothing like prasadam. There absolutely is. I don't care how gourmet you want to get. There's nothing like food that has been sanctified and is prasadam. So that's a whole class we can have right there on prasadam. Okay, so great. So you had a good time last week. We've got a Gadadhar Pandit. Lovely. Again, this verse from the fourth chapter is critical. This is a verse you need. You must know this verse. So let's chant the verse together, and then we'll discuss it. All right. So the melody is very simple. Yeyatamam prapadyanti. So I'll chant a line, and then you chant after me. Yeyap yeyatamam prapadyanti. Try that. Yeyatamam prapadyanti. Tamstataiva bhajami aham. Tamstataiva bhajami aham. Mama vartman vartante. Mama vartman vartante. Manushyak parthasarvasha. Manushyak parthasarvasha. Yeyatamam prapadyante. Yeyatamam prapadyante. Tamstataiva bhajamyaham. Tamstataiva bhajamyaham. Mama vartman vartante. Mama vartman vartante. Manushya parthasarvasha. Manushya parthasarvasha. You would like to try? Yeah? Okay. Yeyatamam prapadyante. Translation to this verse reads as follows. As all surrender unto me, I reward them accordingly. Everyone follows my path in all respects, O son of Pritha. Pritha is another name for Kunti, the mother of the Pandava princess. So son of Pritha means Arjuna. As all surrender unto me, I reward them accordingly. Everyone follows my path in all respects. I'd like to read the purport for you here on the next page. Everyone is searching for Krishna in the different aspects of his manifestations. Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is partially realized in his impersonal Brahma Jyoti refulgence. And as the all-pervading Supersoul, dwelling within everything, including the particles of atoms. But Krishna is fully realized only by his pure devotees. Consequently, Krishna is the object of everyone's realization. And thus anyone and everyone is satisfied according to one's desire to have him. In the transcendental world also, Krishna reciprocates with his pure devotees in the transcendental attitude, just as the devotees want him. One devotee may want Krishna as supreme master, another as his personal friend, another as his son, and still another as his lover. Krishna rewards all the devotees equally according to their different intensities of love for him. In the material world, the same reciprocations of feelings are there, and they are equally exchanged by the Lord with the different types of worshippers. The pure devotees, both here and in the transcendental abode, associate with him in person and are able to render personal service to the Lord and thus derive transcendental bliss in his loving service. As for those who are impersonalists and who want to commit spiritual suicide by annihilating the individual existence of the living entity, Krishna helps also by absorbing them into his effulgence. Such impersonalists do not agree to accept the eternal, blissful personality of Godhead. Consequently, they cannot relish the bliss of transcendental personal service to the Lord, having extinguished their individuality. Some of them, who are not firmly situated even in the impersonal existence, return to this material field to exhibit their dormant desires for activities. They are not admitted into the spiritual planets, but they are again given a chance to act on the material planets. For those who are fruitive workers, the Lord awards the desired results of their prescribed duties as the Yajneshwara. Yajneshwara means, literally translated, the Ishwara, or the Lord of Yajna, or sacrifice, meaning whatever we do, the result is dependent not just on our own initiative and effort, but there is a higher power, a higher force at work that participates in the outcome of our endeavors. And those who are yogis seeking mystic powers are awarded such powers. In other words, everyone is dependent for success upon his mercy alone, and all kinds of spiritual processes are but different degrees of success on the same path. I want to read that sentence again. In other words, everyone is dependent for success upon his mercy alone, and all kinds of spiritual processes are but different degrees of success on the same path. Unless, therefore, one comes to the highest perfection of Krishna consciousness, all attempts remain imperfect. As is stated in the Srimad Bhagavatam, akama sarva kamo va moksha kamo daradi tivrena bhakti yogena yajeta purusham param. Whether one is without desires, which is the condition of the devotees, or is desirous of all fruitive results, or is after liberation, one should with all efforts try to worship the Supreme Personality of Godhead for complete perfection, culminating in Krishna consciousness. Hare Krishna. Well, there's a lot here. There's a lot here. What Prabhupada has done in the purport, and that's the reason for his purports, is to unpack some of the deeper meaning of these very dense verses. When Krishna says, Yaya tamam prapadyante, as they prapati, as they surrender to me, as people give themselves to me, tamstataiva bhajamyaham, I reciprocate. I'm there for you as you would like me to be, is what he's saying. And then what Prabhupada is doing in the purport is saying, well, what are the different ways that people approach Krishna? And he's describing the basic categories here. The basic categories are that there are those who are not particularly interested in God or having a relationship with God? God has got a bad press image. He's been so poorly represented for so long that when you think of the word alone is a negative word for a lot of people. What does it mean, God? Well, about as much information as people have is something rather unpleasant. You know, and for a thinking person, referencing God feels like a cop-out. You know, as if you don't understand what's really going on, then you talk about God. You know, if you don't understand the workings of nature, if you haven't appreciated the nuances of, you know, Darwinian naturalism, if you don't have a sense of how the universe is self-sufficient without need to reference some supreme being, then sure, maybe for you there's need of faith and church and worship and prayers and beads and, you know, all of that stuff is not particularly important to someone who has a more rational, logical approach to the world. So that's one category, what Prabhupada calls fruitive workers. It's an interesting term. The karmi, one who works in the realm of karma, a fruitive worker, meaning you do something because it bears fruit. It has some result, and you're doing it because that's what you want, is that result. So that's one kind of reciprocation. That's one kind of a relationship with the universe, with creation, is it's there for me. You know, I look at the world and I evaluate the world in terms of what can it do for me. That's one category. Another category. And Krishna, the point is that Krishna says, I reciprocate with those people. Now, the limitation there, of course, is that there's a kind of glass ceiling. There's only so much materially that you can achieve in this life. Why is that? Because there are certain conditions that have been set up over the course of previous lives that make dramatic leaps forward unlikely. It doesn't mean that there aren't exceptions. I mean, you know, for every rule, there are exceptions. And yes, it is possible to break out of a karmic environment. We see that all the time. People coming from destitute circumstances. Someone grows up in a ghetto environment with, you know, abusive parents or whatever the history may be. And they become president. Or they become wildly successful in some business venture, or they become a community leader, and they rise above their circumstances, is often the way we describe that. So, and that's possible. Karma, it can be old, but it is not permanent. Karma is changeable. That's important to understand. You're not limited by your karma. If you don't make an effort, then you're limited by your karma. That's the important thing to understand. Is that if you don't do anything, there's a certain amount of success, a certain amount of failure, a certain amount of pleasure, a certain amount of pain, a certain amount of progress that's going to happen automatically just by the momentum that you've built up over the course of lifetimes. In our Saturday Isopanishad classes, we've been learning about how it is that when you go down to the workings of the material energy on a very, very small scale, something rather remarkable happens. What you see is that the participation of an observer changes the outcome of events. Amazing. That somehow, by our conscious and willful participation, we actually influence the outcome of events. Something that is otherwise unpredictable becomes determined by our participation. So that's one kind of reciprocation that people have with Krishna, is through the agency of the material energy. Another category that Prabhupada is describing here is the Mayavada school. We've been doing a lot of discussion about the Mayavada school as well. And for the longest time, honestly, you know, we from the first generation of Hare Krishna devotees, we couldn't figure out, why is Prabhupada harping on the Mayavadis? You know, why is he always so insistent that we be able to show the defect in the impersonalist philosophy? Mayavada philosophy says that the world around us is an illusion. It's a dream. It doesn't exist. And there's something rather appealing about that. I mean, if you think about, I wasn't here, you were here last week, Gadadhar Pandit spoke with you, today it seems like a dream. Doesn't it? I mean, you kind of remember it, but it doesn't seem real like this seems real. And this class today, a week from now, is going to seem like a dream as well. Everything is in a state of constant deterioration and disappearance. Everything is changing all the time in the material world. So the Mayavada school says that's because it's unreal. It doesn't even really exist. You're not even really here right now. The Mayavada school says you are God. But for the time being, you've forgotten that. Now, of course, they'd have to explain how it is that forgetfulness or Maya has become stronger than God. Why would God ever forget his own identity? So there's some inconsistencies in the philosophy. And generally, Prabhupada describes elsewhere in the Gita that the reason why somebody would approach that school of thinking is that being a person has been painful. They have a bad experience of being a person. You know, being a person is sad, it's involves heartbreak and disappointment. So negate personhood and become one with God. So it's more psychological than philosophical. This is really interesting. When people espouse positions, whether it's an interpretation of history or philosophy or whatever it may be, always remind yourself that they're coming at this from a very autobiographical perspective. Very often, we camouflage with sophisticated ideas an emotional condition that we're harboring inside ourselves. And that's the situation with the Mayavadis, is that, you know, there's a very sophisticated philosophy of how the Atma merges with the totality of Brahman, and you know. But there, you know, it doesn't hold up to scrutiny. So you have to ask why that's the case.
What was the second one? The second relationship? First one was Shuddha.
This is impersonalist or Mayavada.
That's the third one.
That's the second category that Prabhupada is describing. When Krishna says, as they surrender unto me, I reciprocate, I reward them accordingly. You know, how do you want to love me? That's how I will be for you. He's very accommodating. You know, if you want a material life, a full material life, the facilities will be there for you. If you want to become God, he'll provide you with the philosophy and the excuse to put yourself in that position. It doesn't last, you know, but he'll give you that opportunity to pursue that goal. And he said, I will absorb you into my Brahman energy. If that's really what you want, you don't want me, you want my energy. Fine, you know. I'll reciprocate with that way with you. The other category that Prabhupada describes here are the yogis, the mystic yogis. The goal of yoga meditation, you don't hear this too often in class, but the goal of the yoga practice is to realize the Paramatma, who is a indwelling form of Krishna situated in the heart. That's the focus of meditation of the yogis. Those who go into the deep yoga practice, who are in, you know, savikalpa, samadhi for weeks, months, years at a time. They're meditating on the form of Krishna, who is a four-armed form, standing on the lotus whorl within our hearts. Now, this is a very beautiful poetic description of God in the heart. It also has an ontological reality to it, that, you know, Paramatma is not just a poetic idea. God lives within us. You might say it's that voice of higher wisdom that comes out sometimes when you're confronted with something and you say to yourself, I really shouldn't do that, but I'm going to do it anyway. That's that I really shouldn't do that is an impulse that comes from that indwelling witness of all of our actions. So we're getting dictation from God in our hearts all the time. And that's also a way of Krishna reciprocating. And then he says that Prabhupada talks about the pure devotees, those people who have overcome the psychic hurdles, the philosophical hurdles, the karmic hurdles, the material desires, everything that stands in the way of our establishing the ecstatic loving relationship, which is ultimately the soul's place, the ultimate reciprocation with God, with Krishna, is one of ecstatic love. So the verse here, I mean, this is Krishna talking to Arjuna, right? Just putting it into some context here. They're on the battlefield. Arjuna is hesitating to fight, and Krishna is gradually bringing him around to do the very thing that he never wanted to do. I mean, to get back into the action and to act in a decisive way, a very, very decisive way. And for a lot of people, that's a difficult thing to do. We don't necessarily consider ourselves warriors, you know, and thank God we actually don't have to take up arms physically and go into battle in Afghanistan or wherever. I don't think anybody here is in that position. But metaphorically, we are on the battlefield of our own lives, and we're going to have to face the fire at one time or another. So here's Krishna kind of pushing Arjuna toward that place by saying, look, you really want to leave here and you want to go to the forest and just avoid the problem? You want to walk away? You want to walk away? Okay. There's no insistence, you know, thou shalt fight. You know, there's no pronouncements like that here. It's a reasoned discussion between two caring individuals where Krishna gives Arjuna all kinds of options. There's always options going on here. And he's saying, look, if that's what you want, I will reciprocate with you in that way. I'll be there for you in a passive, you know, I'll do for you what I can. But ultimately, where this is leading is to a different place. And that different place, it's a little hard for us to contemplate because it's usually the very thing, like Arjuna, that we never want to do. There's something that we have to do. You may not even know what it is yet, but there's something in your life that you have to do. Usually, my experience has been it means exposing yourself to ridicule. Exposing yourself to the risk of being marginalized, losing something that's dear, you know, risking it, gambling with something that you would rather not endanger or jeopardize somehow. And yet, to move forward, you know, no pain, no gain, nothing risked, nothing ventured, nothing lost. You know, there comes a point where we have to do that. And each of us have to do that. And we have to do it different ways at different stages in our life. So that's what Krishna is saying. Essentially, he's offering some reassurance. Take the risk. Take the risk. Do it. Go that extra distance. And you will not be alone. You will not have to do that on your own. The second half, of course, is very important. Everyone follows my path in all respect. That's the other side of this. You can walk away from it. But you can't walk away from Krishna. You're going to be part of this magnificent creation, whether you like it or not. And the creation has a purpose. It has functioning. It has an energy and a dynamism to it. And we're a part of that as well. So even if you want to walk away, I was reading an article this morning in the New York Review of Books about, now I'm going to forget the author's name, someone who wrote a book on teleology. Teleology is kind of a halfway believer's response to Darwinian evolutionary theory. Teleology says that, in a sense, nature is God. That there is intent behind creation, but you don't have to call it Krishna. You don't have to go that far. You know, you have to go to that religious extreme. You can envision that there is a purposefulness to the way nature is working, right? It's a kind of hedging of bets. You know?
How is purpose being defined?
Purpose is being defined in the way that nature and evolution favor the development of species. In the material sense, yes, in the development of certain survival faculties, for example. That there's a kind of trial and error that nature goes through. There are certain traits, certain survival traits that survive and others that don't. You know, species go extinct because they haven't learned to adapt properly. But it's all moving forward in a way that favors life. So you might say that the universe favors life, right? So, you know, it's, you know, universe, universe, life, life. Universe, universe, life, 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 universe, universe. It's a substitution of something that avoids the unpleasant implications of religion. And there are so many unpleasant implications in religion that we want to avoid them as far as we possibly can. So, you know, there'll be these kind of hedging of bets. The awkwardness there is that it's a cowardly way of dealing with things. It's not a sincere, wholehearted way of dealing with things. Because if you accept the teleological implication, then you have to ask yourself, where did that intentionality come from? You can't just ascribe intent to nature and get away with, now we've figured everything out. Now we know how it all works. You label something, that doesn't mean you've understood it. Right? So eventually, we come to this place of having to confront the very thing that we don't really want to confront, which is the potential, at least, of a divine supreme being, that there's an individual behind all this. It's not just happenstance and favorable circumstances. That very few people want to do. That's the line of demarcation right there. And it's always been this way. So the way my spiritual master dealt with that was by giving people delicious prasadam. He used to call Krishna consciousness kitchen religion. Huh? And he would just, you know, make sure. He was adamant about this, that anyone who came to visit, any guests who came to speak with him, or anyone who visited the temple, nobody should ever leave without having had a plate of prasadam.
Still goes on today.
And it still goes on today. Yeah.
So, going back to that text, everyone follows my path in all respects. Mm-hmm. If our Arjuna abdicates his duty to do what he, as a warrior, should be doing, right, how does Krishna, and so he doesn't fight, how is he still a Christian?
He's following the path in the sense that nothing is ever completely cut off from the original source of everything. You can develop a mentality an isolationist mentality. But it doesn't mean that somehow you've magically exempted yourself from creation. And Krishna, because he, this is going to sound rather Christian, but I these are the words that come to mind and to heart, because Krishna loves you, he finds a way of taking your rebellious posture and bringing you back around. Somehow, we're all going to get back to Krishna. The question is when? And how much hurt do we have to put ourselves through before we get there? You don't have to. That's up to us. Yeah.
All right. So, sort of this Leela keeps coming around, it seems like, in the last couple of weeks, I think, because of the class of Upanishads and tonight. And I'm reading V.S.K. Iyengar's book on yoga, and we can all recognize he is one of two great yoga acharyas of the West.
Light of Yoga?
Yeah, Light of Yoga. Tom Joyce, V.S.K. Iyengar, brought yoga to the West, and they are the authorities on the yoga that we practice. And in his book, V.S.A., when he's talking about the niyamas, he talks about it's the fourth niyamas. He talks about the self. And what he says in the self, he says, you cannot realize the self, which is the goal of most people that practice yoga, unless you have bhakti. It is impossible to understand your true identity unless you have bhakti. And in order to have bhakti, you must have an individual personal relationship with God. He says, right. Otherwise you will never ever find who you really are without that.
That's coming out more and more these days. That was not understood as clearly in years gone by. But it's the bhakti is on the rise, shall we say. And you know what's fascinating about it is that it crosses over into everything. In the corporate world, the most effective way of corporate reform is don't talk about the company, talk about the individual.
But self is with a capital S. it's the universal. When they say self with a capital S, isn't it?
Your true nature. Who
but it's the nature that resides in all.
I'm missing something. Who's talking about the self?
When you in Gita, when it's capitalized, I interpreted it as talking about.
Yes, that's one convention that's used in the text, is that if it's a capital S, it's usually referring to the Supreme Self or God,
which you can feel, which exists in everything. Right? Which are,
yes, there, that's the Paramatma feature in all living beings.
Within
the atoms, Prabhupada makes that explicitly clear. Andantarastam paramanu chayantarastam govindam aripurusham tamaham bhajami. In the Brahma Samhita, it says God exists between the atoms and within the atoms.
So the message about, complete devotion to understand self, it might be. Could it not be talking about the universal self? You'll feel that's the way you...
It's simultaneous. The example that Prabhupada used to use is when the sun rises in the morning, you see the sun and you also see yourself. Because now you've become illumined.
Right.
So by perceiving the Supreme Self, you begin to cultivate an understanding of yourself, with a small s, as a spiritual being. Yeah, it happens simultaneously. Yeah, by cultivating Krishna consciousness, you're cultivating self-awareness at the same time. Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
You know how this is called sunset Gita? Is it a time of study? Like in the morning, you meditate and the sunrise. Is there anything significant to studying?
Oh, in the morning, absolutely.
I mean, you study all day, but is there something significant at sunset?
Well, yeah, because we start at 8 p.m. we tried it in the morning. We tried it. Remember, it was Sunday. We had it Sunday morning. It was called Sunrise Gita. Right? And it started at what time in the morning?
I think.
Was it 8 a.m.?
I
Something like
it was before Lady Ruth's class.
Right. It was before Lady Ruth's class, so it must have been 8 o'clock. And, you know, I mean, just people relish their Sunday mornings. You know, we had a nice group, but it was like very small. And so we decided to opt for sunset. But just to take your question seriously, there is a period in the morning called Brahma Muhurta. Brahma Muhurta lasts about 47 minutes, to be technical. And it's the 47 minutes just before sunrise. That particular time is considered the most auspicious time of day for meditation, study, chanting, prayers, services, ceremonies. The phrase Brahma Muhurta simply means the auspicious time of day. And so that's when you'll find a lot of the ceremonies taking place in temples is during the Brahma Muhurta hour.
So. But nothing significant at the sunset.
About the sunset? It's when people are out of work and they can come. And well, there is, all right, there's a prayer that Krishna devotees chant to the spiritual master. Yasa prasadad bhagavat prasadad yasa prasadad nakatir katopi dayam stuvam stasya yasastri sandhyam. Trisandhya means three times during the day. Morning, afternoon, and evening. That yasa prasadad bhagavat prasadad yasa prasadad nakatir katopi, that by the grace of the spiritual master, one is blessed with the grace of Krishna, of God. And by the grace of Krishna, one is blessed with having a spiritual master. And without the blessing of the spiritual master, there is nakatir katopi. There's no making spiritual progress. There's only so much distance you can traverse on your own. We have to admit that at a certain point, we need guidance. We need guidance. And that means very carefully searching out someone who can be at least an instructing, if not an initiating teacher. And one, the prayer says, should remember the teacher three times daily. So, and remembering the teacher means studying the teachings. So, trishandhyam, three times during the day, morning, afternoon, and evening, there should be. So you punctuate your day. You're never going for too long a stretch without refreshing yourself spiritually. Yeah? Okay. Yeah.
The idea of risk and what that means to get into yourself. I'd be curious to know more about that because it seems all well and good to have practice and it seems all well and good to understand what these modes are, but the risk. Yeah,
how does risk factor into our spiritual practice?
Yeah, because we find our society right now to be incredibly safety based, and risk is something that we're averse to in general. And we hear constantly not to take real risk. I mean, some marginal risk. So how do we weigh out the sort of deep calling of this particular period? And the personal risks that we sort of do see, because when we think about Afghanistan, let's say, I see that as being one very extreme, very sort of incredibly difficult role to take on, where one is going to surround the self with incredible violence, incredible difficulty. And then there's the modern lifestyle, which also has a very
All right, let me make a suggestion, because you're conflating two very different realms of risk. And I think we need to sort them out. It's one thing to talk about the Kshatriya class, or the military class, which, now you have to breathe into this one a little bit. There is nothing unspiritual about being prepared to combat aggression. In fact, to not be prepared to respond to aggression, which is unfortunately inevitable in this world, is cowardly, it's foolish, and it's dangerous to the population. Good government, and the Vedic conception means a spiritually motivated government, a government that really has the interests of the citizens at heart, will make sure that the citizens are first and foremost protected from harm. And that means that there must be armed services. There has to be a military. We may not like that. We might prefer this kind of idealized vision of the world as a place where, you know, I ain't gonna go to war no more. You know, and as a guy who grew up in the 60s, you know, I was weaned on that stuff. But realistically, being prepared is not just a governmental responsibility. It's a spiritual duty to be prepared to defend that which is important. We're not a part of that Kshatriya class. We're, as far as I know, nobody here this evening is in the military. So it, risk in the sense that I think you're asking about it is not necessarily... That may not be the most effective example for us this evening. On the other hand, what you're talking about, where we're risk aversive in our culture, you know, we don't like to take unnecessary risk, that's relevant. The kind of risk that I think is inculcated by devotional service, by bhakti yoga, is the risk of stepping outside what we sometimes call our comfort zones for a good cause. That's devotion. That's bhakti. Bhakti means don't become so complacent in your life that you forget that the great prerogative, the great privilege of human life is to care for others. There's just no way around that extension of yourself to the well-being of others in yoga life, and in particular, devotional yoga life. There's no separating self-realization from other realization. You cannot progress spiritually if the only thing you're focusing on is yourself. It's a contradiction. So to extend yourself to others means taking some risks on their behalf. Now, what is that risk? Well, it could be something as simple as sacrificing some of your time for the well-being of others. It could mean contributing resources in some way. Usually, skills and know-how are important. You know, my daughter, bless her heart, is a champion of the underdog. You know, every summer since she started college, she's either gone to Alaska to work on behalf of the native peoples there, or she's worked for the Native Americans in Montana. And, you know, I mean, she's always doing something. She just got back from a training course on climate change, and she works for a nonprofit that tries to foster healthier organic eating habits on college campuses. I mean, it's just like, I don't know where she got all that, but, you know, bless her heart.
And are all these practices part of her?
She somehow comes to it naturally. You know, she gets Krishna consciousness kind of intuitively. She doesn't chant on beads, at least as far as I know. And I think she kind of instinctively, you know, kind of gets that. That's a nice way of putting it. Responsible risk. I like that. I like that.
But it will unfold out of you.
Yeah, if you're open to it, the opportunities will present themselves. You don't. It's not going to. The need is so great. You're not going to have to try very hard, you know, before some opportunity will present itself for you to take some risk on behalf of others. I don't want us to lose sight of something, however. And that is, there's this one critical quality that differentiates the risk you take on behalf of others from being totally mundane. And that is that you are doing so because you see Krishna in their heart. If you are understanding that the reason for me to step out of my comfort zone and to take risk in order to help people is because those people are every bit as spiritual as I am, now your service to them is more than just a temporary material service. You will find a way to infuse it with that added dimension of bhakti. So, serving food to the homeless is not by definition bhakti. That's not bhakti. Bhakti is when the food you serve them is prasadam. Now it's bhakti. Okay? Bhakti isn't just building a home for people who have lost their home in Hurricane Sandy. That's social action. Bhakti is when you are walking the life of devotion, and by your presence you're inspiring people into doing something more than just thanking you for helping put their house together. There is a quality to someone who is seeing spiritually, just like we were describing earlier, that the same dish, if it's been offered with devotion, it tastes different. Your service will taste different if it's moving forward from that place of Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. I am a spark of Krishna. So are these people. What can I do to serve them? Now you're in bhakti. You see the difference? Okay. Ah, well, yeah.
Sure.
But that's healthy. That's okay. As long as you don't become, you know, neurotic about it, you know, just like, you know, end up catatonic. That sense that I'm not doing enough, that's a very healthy sentiment. Because we don't. We never do enough. We're never doing enough. I'm never doing enough. That's a good thing. That's an impetus to action. That will help you, kind of staying always a little bit on the edge of your seat. That's a very, very good thing. Bravo. Keep that. That's a healthy thing. So, one or two more questions and then we'll do RT.
Can you, since we talked about government, can you explain, according to the Vedas, the proper form of society? Something interesting that we never talked about?
Well, what is the Vedic form? You mean the organizing of society?
So, like, you know, our leaders are not saying, doing unnecessarily harm, even in, like, ages of the samsara, even during the first and second, third age, there was.
Yeah, I'm just reading about this because I'm researching a biography of Prabhupada, so I'm reading just about this stuff. He didn't hold much faith in the value of the democratic process. He was much more in favor of an appointed leader. The reason is that the mass of people are too distracted by their own needs, too vulnerable to the empty promises of politicians, and too wary of religion to be able to make a clear-headed decision about who to elect on their own recognizance. So Prabhupada was much more inclined to having a community of brahminically trained men and women who could make that decision on behalf of the general populace. And in the Vedic times, kings were not voted into office. The regent, emperor, king, leader was appointed by a council of brahminical authority. And that leader was then responsible to that council of Brahmins. So they didn't have dictatorial power. They were also controlled, just as we have, you know, the three divisions of American government. There's checks and balances. So the Vedic system also has checks and balances. But the ultimate check and balance is the Brahminical authority. That's a council of people, men and women, who have been trained in Krishna consciousness and in bhakti, devotion, and who are living that life and have the respect of the citizenry to make the best decisions on their behalf. So there's a relegating of that one man, one vote authority to a council of Brahmins voluntarily, because the understanding is this group collectively is a lot smarter than we are. So there was, you know, monarchy, you know, in some respects, I think it might technically be called an oligarchy, but I'm not quite sure. And the king was not just somebody who led from the Oval Office. That person was on the front line. Like if we're in Afghanistan, the president would be there on the front line with the soldiers. You want to wage a war? Get out there and wage it. Show how to do it. That's the Vedic system. And if there is one person in the nation who is suffering from lack of adequate food or shelter or medical attention, that's on the leader's responsibility. It's on that person's shoulders. There shouldn't be one person in the entire nation who is destitute of the basics of life. That's the Vedic system. Yeah? The what?
Mayavada.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And then the perspective established in this book in the Isopanishad. Right? That has some sort of relation to quantum physics and the fact that the observer changes the nature of matter that you're observing.
Right.
But it's just, once you've made that observation, you're sort of stuck with the material world the way that it is in any moment, right? And I sort of feel like there's equally plausible justification for the Mayavada perspective in neuroscience, right? That we're not really seeing things objectively. Everything is being filtered by our perception, by our brain.
Yes.
So we are only seeing small proportions.
Absolutely. Well, you're absolutely correct. Not only does neurological science tend to support the notion that we're living a dream, but also in certain phenomena of quantum mechanics, for example, in what's called the Bose-Einstein condensate, there is evidence that suggests that ultimately everything dissolves into a oneness. The Bose-Einstein condensate describes a phenomenon in nature where some subatomic particles, mostly bosons, but to some extent all subatomic particles, when you bring them down in temperature close to absolute zero, they tend to lose their specificity. So these little points of subatomic particles tend to become wave potentials. And they kind of, it's like melting a pat of butter. and they tend to just kind of merge into one another. And a particle no longer knows whether it's a part of this grouping of wave potentials or whether it's become a part of that group of wave potentials. And you reach a point where this condensate, as it's called, really resembles the Mayavada vision of a Brahman oneness to all things. Here's the one difference that
Bhagavad Gita and the Bhakti philosophy adds, who is it who's observing all of this merging of particles into a condensate oneness? Who is it who's contemplating that loss of identity, that loss of ego, that becoming one with all creation? Who is that? The individual awareness is what never loses its unique specificity. The soul never dissolves. It's the one, it's the Achilles heel in the entire Mayavada philosophy. That by definition, the soul, if it is now individual, which we are, we're individuals now, then we must be individuals eternally. You cannot, you're not a pat of butter. You're not going to melt in the pan. You're an indestructible spark of energy, of divine energy, and it has form and uniqueness. It is an, you are an irreducible, unique individual, beautiful and perfect in your own way, different from all other individuals. Now, some individuals, because they're unhappy, may want to merge, may want to become a melted pat of butter. But that's that individual's aspiration. It is not a law that somehow negates the individuality of soul.
So there is something that separates it, us from material reality.
Absolutely.
And the illusory nature is part of the material world.
It's the perception of the individual. That's correct. And the difference in our attitude as bhaktas, as devotees, is that this world, while it may be temporary, is not an illusion. This is also the kingdom of God. This is also real. And to turn our backs on this world on the pretext that it's just a dream is the most offensive attitude that one can have. Because this is God-given. This is our arena. This is our yogic studio, this world. This is where we achieve the fullness of our spiritual being. By taking the opportunity of a problematic world and going out and offering service. Finding a way to become a participant in this temporary but divine creation. That's the message of the Gita. Ooh, okay. Good questions. Nice. You going to do some RT?
Couple of announcements?
Yeah?
Because for the new people, we have a mailing list sign up sheet. We put it away by accident. Chairs going to get to pass out. So if anybody who hasn't signed up wants to sign up to get our newsletter for classes that are happening here in another location for our teacher, you will be on that list to get that. Second, we have two books that are donation based. George Harrison's autobiography, Spiritual Journey by our teacher, Yogi Shvar, and Gita Wisdom, which is a required text for a lot of teacher trainings by Yogi Shvar. Third announcement is
good front man.
Would like to participate in making prasadam. Please speak to share. And then the final announcement for this week, or two more, is if anybody would like to participate in arti speak, please speak to me, and I will talk to you about arti. We always would like other people to do arti, so I don't have to do it every week, so please volunteer.
It's easy to do, and it's a very rewarding experience. So if you'd like to try doing the arti one week, you're welcome to do that.
This is the best place to do it, too, because it's all practice here, and you can't do anything wrong here. And then the final one is the final class of the Ishapanishads.
Yeah, it's this Saturday at 6. Yeah.
And we are going over the verses this week, correct?
Yeah, we're going to go over the verses of Ishapanishad. We're going to see a film clip of the physiological and psychological effects of the various poses in a yoga routine, in a vinyasa exercise flow. And then we're going to talk about the connection between yoga and bhakti as described in the Ishapanishad. So that's Saturday. Thank you.
Book is on sale for $6, I think.
Something like that.
It's in the